Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We're always delighted to have the uncommon intelligence and great sagacity of Gordon Chang available to us, especially at a moment when things in Asia are demanding more and more serious attention and unfortunately aren't getting it in every sense. We're talking with Gordon as senior U.S. officials head off to South Asia, and I want to get his take on that. Gordon is, of course, a columnist for the Daily Beast. You see him frequently at Fox and in other media outlets, the National Interest among them. You also, I hope, are familiar with his two terrific books, The Coming Collapse of China and Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
So, Jim Mattis and Mike Pompeo are visiting capitals in South Asia, specifically, I believe Mike Pompeo will be in Islamabad, Pakistan tomorrow, and he and his counterpart at the Defense Department will be at the capital of India, New Delhi, the following day. Talk a little bit about this trip, Gordon, and what are the stakes for their visits?
Well, the stakes, of course, are important because India and Pakistan have been at loggerheads. India has been trying to have good relations with Pakistan, but it's been very difficult because Pakistan has been captured by a radical ideology. And clearly they want to cause problems for India, especially in Kashmir, which is disputed territory. For too long, the United States has coddled the Pakistan establishment, and we have overlooked many things that it's been doing, causing trouble in the world, including the proliferation of nuclear weapons to places like Iran and Libya, as well as, of course, North Korea. So at some point, the United States is going to have to make a choice between Pakistan and India, and clearly we need to make the choice with the country that shares our values and which is consistent with the way we view the world, and that, of course, is India.
Yeah, I've done a commentary today, Gordon, that I'd want to run by you. I argue that the standing of Pakistan, and in addition to the problems you've mentioned, of course, there's also Pakistan's active involvement on behalf of the Taliban and other Sharia supremacists in Afghanistan who've been murdering Americans there and otherwise causing mayhem for the Afghans, and China's increasing involvement with Pakistan, including military installations and much more, that argue for revisiting a decision made shortly after 9/11, where we conferred upon Pakistan the status of a major non-NATO ally. Seems to me that it isn't, really, and we ought to be instead viewing India as our major regional ally. Your thoughts?
Yeah, certainly that's true. You know, the other designation that we should give to Pakistan is state sponsor of terrorism, because it has been for a very long time, and it's terrorism not only with regard to Afghanistan, but also with regard to India. We have not done that, despite the facts. And that, I think, casts a shadow on the way we designate countries. We should be absolutely fearless when we do this. Now, I understand the reason why the United States has overlooked this. We wanted help with regard to the Taliban. But nonetheless, there are certain things that cannot be overlooked. And in the long run, we need to ally ourselves with the stronger of those two countries, which is India. They're consistent with our values. They see the world in the same way. They confront the same adversaries. I just don't see an argument for the relations we've had with Pakistan up to now. That's just hideous.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly been overtaken by events, I think it's fair to say. Gordon, you've recently written a piece at the Daily Beast about another challenge that we're facing at the moment, and I wanted to call our audience's attention to it. Talk about the collision course, as you call it, that we're now on with regard to nuclear weapons in Asia, at the hands of the Russians and the Chinese operating jointly at the moment.
Yeah, many people talk about how China is challenging the U.S. Navy, for instance, in its peripheral waters. And in the Western Pacific, we talk about China's asymmetric tactics. What we often forget, of course, is that the Chinese do appear to be prepared to use nuclear weapons against American forces, either as a demonstration to scare us off or actually a direct attack, for instance, on American bases in Japan. China has a declared no first use policy, but statements from Chinese generals and diplomats over the course of decades indicate that they are prepared to use nukes first. And so this is in line with China's good friend, Russia. Vladimir Putin has been talking about the offensive use of nuclear weapons against the Baltics, which are NATO allies. And so we got to be prepared that the Chinese are prepared to escalate very quickly to the most destructive weapons. And in my piece, I cite Rick Fisher, who has looked at this and has talked about how China might use these weapons.
Yeah, and unfortunately, they're probably getting tips on how to do that from their allies. It seems increasingly their strategic allies, the Russians, who have also got policies for, as they call it, escalating to de-escalate that are very ominous indeed. And Gordon, as you look at it, do the United States forces in the region have the credible capacity to deter such nuclear aggression by the Chinese or Russians or both?
Frank, I don't think that we're prepared, actually, to think about these issues because we think in conventional terms, and I mean that not just in conventional weapons, but in established ways of thinking. And we have yet to really wrap our minds about what the Chinese are prepared to do. And in fact, you know, Frank, we're talking about what the Chinese have actually been saying. You know, this is not something where the Chinese have been hiding their intentions and their tactics. They've talked about this. And most notably, in 2011, we've had that retired Chinese general blurt out to the South China Morning Post words which indicate that the Chinese actually were thinking of a surprise nuclear attack on the United States. So we need to be thinking in a much broader context, much more comprehensively about this, because one thing that we've got to be concerned is that the Chinese have overwhelming presence in a number of ships in Asia, all the rest of it. They've got the world's biggest navy since last year, Frank, and they concentrate their forces in a small part of the world where we're spread out. This is exceedingly dangerous for the United States and our friends and partners.
It is, and best be thought seriously about how do we counter it and use such forces as we have, as well as other tools to defeat such threats from China and or Russia. Gordon, we have to leave it at that for the moment. We will look forward to our visit with you next week. Thank you in the meantime for all you do at Fox and the Daily Beast and elsewhere, as well as your visits with us from time to time. It's good to visit with you. We'll talk with you again next week. Next up, we'll speak with Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin bit more about what's happening with Pakistan this week and beyond, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin. He is a man who has contributed mightily to our country's security, both in uniform of the United States Army as a reservist with combat tours in Afghanistan and Iraq, and in his present capacity, which is as a commentator and analyst, frequently appearing, among other places, in the Daily Caller. He has an extraordinary background in the hard sciences as well as in the applied political sciences, and it's always a delight to have a chance to visit with him. Colonel Doctor, it's good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome.
Thank you, Frank.
Well, we're talking at the moment about Pakistan, Lawrence. This is, of course, a country that you've spent a long time studying, interacting with, warning about, particularly of late. I spoke earlier in the program with Gordon Chang about the fact that our Secretary of State is visiting Islamabad tomorrow, the capital of Pakistan. He and Jim Mattis will be in New Delhi in India the following day. And I'm focused on really the question of whether Pakistan today still constitutes a major non-NATO ally for the United States. And who better to discuss that with than you? It's good to have you to visit about it. Tell us a little bit about what Pakistan is up to at the moment that should be of concern to all of us.
Well, Frank, I think there's no mistake, at least in my mind, that Pakistan is not an ally of the United States in any way, shape, or form. They have committed to China as an ally. They're often described as an all-weather ally of China. And more recently, Pakistan and Iran have come to an accommodation. So you're seeing Pakistan allying itself with basically at least one enemy of the United States, which is Iran, but also a global adversary of the United States in China. So I don't think Pakistan can be considered an ally of the United States.
I want to come back to some of the other connections that the Pakistanis are establishing, notably with Russia. But just to stay with China for a moment, Lawrence, the Chinese are, as you've pointed out on this program and elsewhere, busily expanding what I can only describe as a colonial footprint, notably through the vehicle of their Belt and Road Initiative, as they call it. Pakistan features prominently in this. In fact, it's got its own economic program, as I understand it. Give us a sense of what China is doing and whether Pakistan is, like others, being targeted for this kind of hegemony by China, is at risk of falling into the so-called debt trap China's setting.
Well, Pakistan is basically being colonized by China, at least in my opinion. The Chinese have a global program called the Belt and Road Initiative, where they want to, at least economically, become the major power in the world. And the flagship of China's Belt and Road Initiative is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. And due to this, the relationship between Pakistan and China in this regard, the Pakistanis have incurred a lot of debt to China. And that debt is increasing all the time. Just recently, in an Urdu language website, they announced that Pakistan will be taking another loan from China in order to build a railway between the Iranian port of Chabahar and the Pakistani port of Gwadar, which is also the endpoint of the China-Pakistan economic corridor, the land route. So if anything, Pakistan's debt to China is increasing daily.
Yeah, and Gwadar, as I recall, is also a port that the Chinese have their sights on for use by their commercial as well as naval forces. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, Frank. The Belt and Road Initiative is the soft power component, but this is followed by a hard power component where the Chinese are expanding militarily globally, and in particular in Pakistan. There was a report in January that the Chinese planned to build a naval base on the Juwani Peninsula, which is next to Gwadar. But there's also a lot of activity, naval activity, by the Chinese all along the Pakistan coast in the northern Indian Ocean, in particular related to submarine operations.
And so when you see what the Chinese are doing to build this footprint with, obviously, the Pakistanis' consent and full cooperation, this in and of itself would be pretty much grounds for exclusion of the Pakistanis as an ally to the United States, one would think. But then there's the problem that you've also documented, and for that matter, experienced firsthand, of the help that the Pakistanis have been providing to the Taliban and Al-Qaeda and the Haqqani Network and other Sharia supremacist outfits in mounting attacks on the U.S. and their Afghan allies across the border in Afghanistan. Talk a little bit about the current state of that operation.
Well, the Pakistanis have never stopped their support of the Taliban. In fact, almost within 6 to 9 months of 9/11, the Pakistanis were helping the Taliban reconstitute their forces and resupply them. And for the last 17 years, the Taliban have now developed a really huge support network and infrastructure all along the Afghanistan border inside Pakistan. So the Pakistanis see the Taliban as a lever to control Afghanistan, in particular to keep out the Indians from having any influence within Afghanistan.
Yeah, speaking of India, there is, in addition to the Pompeo visit to Pakistan, in the offing, the visit by the Secretary of State and his counterpart at the Defense Department, Secretary James Mattis, this week as well, to, it seems, reaffirm and enhance the U.S. relationship with India. Given what you've said about Pakistan, Lawrence, and given what we know about India and its shared concerns about Chinese encroachment in South Asia, their ongoing efforts to challenge India's border, the degree to which the Chinese are on the march, really, all around them, is this a moment when it would seem sensible for the United States to be, well, I guess in the Navy they call it shifting our colors, moving the designation of a major non-NATO ally from Pakistan to the other major regional power with whom we're much more aligned, namely India?
Well, the short answer, Frank, is yes. Removing a non-NATO ally designation from Pakistan is one of the few levers we have left to use against Pakistan. As you know, recently we have stopped the $300 million in military aid to Pakistan, and this is probably the final lever that we can use against Pakistan, is removing their designation as a non-NATO ally. From there, I think we need to look at additional levers that we haven't tapped into yet. And that, in my mind, has to do with inhibiting the China-Pakistan economic corridor, and with a particular focus on Balochistan.
I did want to talk to you about that, too. But before we do, let me just ask you about one other piece of this. An impediment over the years to our really consolidating a strategic relationship, even an alliance with India, has been its ongoing ties to Russia. And it seems as though Pakistan is now working assiduously to try to attach itself to Russia as well as China. Can you shed any light on that, Lawrence Sellin?
Yes, that's right, Frank. The strategic conditions in South Asia are changing as we speak. There is an effort now among four nations, Russia, China, Pakistan, and Iran, with a particular focus on nudging the United States out of Afghanistan. So not only has Pakistan a relationship with China and has a developing relationship with Iran, but is now trying to work with Russia as well as an alternative to the United States in South Asia.
So again, another tool, especially as we throw Iran into the mix, and as you've indicated, the rapprochement between Pakistan and Iran, it does seem as though the Baluchi card, if you will, does need to be played. It would have implications on both sides of the Pakistani-Iranian border, as I understand it. Talk a little bit about how that card might, in fact, be utilized to advantage the United States in this dynamic region.
Well, Balochistan is a province of Pakistan, its southwestern province. But the Baluchi people actually also live in Iran, and they have a history of an independence movement and have long sought independence from Pakistan, but at least autonomy within Iran. So I think there's a possibility of the United States leveraging the Baluchis in opposition to both Iran and Pakistan and the moves that China is making within the region.
Fascinating stuff, and I'm sure going to be very much a focus of high-level attention in the days of this week and beyond. We look forward to continuing our visits with you and learning more from you. Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sellin, United States Army Reserves, retired. It's always a delight to have you, and I hope you'll let us do so again very soon. Next up, we will be speaking with Matthew Brodsky about developments in Syria with some of these same actors and what they might mean not only for that region, but for you, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I'm delighted to say we have Kevin Freeman, a senior fellow of the Center for Security Policy and the driving force behind globaleconomicwarfare.com, as well as Economic War Room with Kevin Freeman. He is the author of two best-selling books, Secret Weapon and Game Plan, and a font of information about the nature of economic warfare at the moment and the extent to which it is being waged against us with, unfortunately, increasing effect. Kevin, it's good to have you back. Thank you so much for taking some time to visit with us about the myriad topics that are of interest to you and should be to all of us.
Always good to join you, Frank.
Well, I hardly know where to begin, to be honest with you. I think that one place is the general state of the economic warfare being waged against this country by two nations in particular, Russia and China. Let's start with what the Russians are up to, Kevin.
Well, that's good. There's a lot of attention regarding China, and I'm pleased to see it. Discussions about trade, discussions about intellectual property theft, but a hidden economic war attack that attacks that have been ongoing for quite some time. We've talked about them here. Russia has been attempting to undermine American hegemony globally, economic, political, and everything else. And it's not the idea that's being pushed in the media, which, oh, they colluded with the Trump campaign to keep Hillary Clinton out of office. That's not the case. The case of where they're really the thrust of their effort is in undermining the dollar. They have been trying to destroy the institutions that hold up the dollar for quite some time, undermining American confidence. They have been funding groups that are anti-American group. They've been doing it back since KGB days, but it's ramped up recently where they've been using environmental groups to try and stop American energy development. They've been trying to stop pipelines. They've been trying to create unrest among racial tensions and different divides in America. So Russia is a serious problem. It's just not the one we've been told.
Yeah. It sounds as though there's a lot of deflection going on from sort of the serious problems that it poses, as well as, let's be clear, collusion on the part of a lot of Democrats over the years with the Russians that has also been obscured by the present focus on the alleged Trump collusion with Russia. China has, in a similar fashion, been working to supplant the institutions that have done much to shape the post-World War II economic order. They are also assaulting the dollar. They are also, it seems, engaged in intense influence operations against us. And I just would like your sort of comparison of the level of efforts between the Russians and the Chinese, as well as evidence that they're collaborating with one another against us.
Well, prior to 2013, the Russians had been pushing and working against our institutions, but the Chinese were not ready to join them. And in 2013, there was a dramatic shift when we had the government shutdown, where the Chinese realized, you know, at the highest levels in government, they realized that they were really truly dependent on American decisions. And so they began to undermine and separate to replace the International Monetary Fund, to replace the SWIFT interbank transaction systems, to replace the World Bank, and so forth. They even began an official policy to de-Americanize the world, and it's been hiding in plain sight. They said, we want to remove the dollar as the global reserve currency and replace it with the Chinese yuan and other currencies. It's just out there, and yet it was virtually ignored during the Obama administration, and it's been partially recognized during the Trump administration, at least in the context of the trade war and the intellectual property theft and so forth. But those are means to achieve their end. The primary end is to replace America at the top of the economic pyramid.
Yeah. Well, and I would argue, and I think you do too, not just the economic pyramid, but sort of strategically as well, which has enormous implications for a lot of things that we care about, needless to say. Let me ask you about a couple of related issues, Kevin Freeman. There is a piece that came to my attention from KCI Research Limited, which argues that there is reason to believe that instead of the very low interest rates that the U.S. government has been able to pay for borrowing in recent years, something called the Taylor Rule is pointing towards something on the order of a 7.5% interest rate is what's in order, and there may be a correction to move us closer to that. Is that your understanding, and help us all understand what the Taylor Rule is and what the implications of such a correction would be?
Well, the Taylor Rule is an inflation-based rule. If you have a certain level of inflation, the appropriate Federal Reserve response is to set interest rates at a certain price. But interest rates and economic activity have been disconnected for quite some time. Our interest rate in no way reflects the current economic situation because we had that huge problem in 2008, and the Federal Reserve drove interest rates below anything we ever expected, and they actually were tame compared to the European Central Bank and others, who took interest rates actually into negative territory, to where the borrower was paid to borrow money as opposed to the lender being paid to loan money. But the Taylor Rule would argue, and normal economic times would argue, that something on the order of a 7.5% Fed funds rate would be normal. The problem with that would be, of course, we have a $21 trillion interest rate. If you were paying 5% on $20 trillion, it's $1 trillion a year, which would eat up about a third of all of the tax revenues we take in. At 7.5% on $21 trillion, you're taking half of all the taxes. So it becomes an unsustainable problem. And this goes to a grave point, a really serious issue, is that we have market complacency and debt complacency as I've never witnessed in my career, to where nobody's worried about the fact that the deficit continues to run and the debt continues to run. The market is at all-time highs, and yet we have all of these dreadful factors out there that could come home to roost, and the Chinese and the Russians and others are looking for ways to make that happen.
Yeah, make it happen and to exploit it. And it seems as though our so-called European allies are willing to play along as well, at least to the extent to which they are now actively challenging the U.S. leadership on Iran with a view to propping up the government there that, last time I checked, is threatening them at least as much as it is us with ballistic missiles that could already range Europe and against which there is scarcely any defense at all. Kevin, talk a little bit about what is going on between the Europeans and the Iranians at the moment.
Well, it doesn't make sense from a standpoint of who would you rather do trade with, Iran or the United States. But it's a reality that the European nations are saying the U.S. should not have control of the global monetary system if they're going to put sanctions on nations like Iran. And this all emerges from John Kerry. When he was Secretary of State, when he put the Iran deal in place, he staked the Obama administration, his career on this as the crowning achievement. And then he threatened, if we ever put sanctions back on the Iranians again, it will threaten the U.S. dollar. And I don't think this would have bubbled up until he did his little Europe tour. And he traveled to Europe and he visited. These are globalists, and the globalists do not want America to exercise power to benefit what they perceive are American interests. Now, stopping the Iranians from developing nuclear bomb, I believe, is in the world interest, but they just don't want us in charge, at least not if it's President Trump. And so this threat has come out that they're going to go around the U.S. systems, U.S. controlled systems, and undermine the dollar because they want to make a big moral case on this Iranian nuclear bomb deal that was a disaster. So this is John Kerry. This is a part of normal politics. This is globalization, and it's putting the entire world at threat.
Germany in particular seems to be aggressively pursuing this. Our colleague David Goldman, and I'll be talking more about this in the latter part of the week, but Kevin Freeman, does it seem fair to say that the Germans are working rather assiduously against our interests, not just with respect to Iran and our efforts to terminate a threat posed by the regime there, but much more broadly as well?
Well, they're working against the interests of the German people, from the immigration policies and so forth. There are a group of globalists that are running most of these European nations, and they have globalization as their ultimate aim, regardless of the consequences. And John Kerry fits in that mold, the Germans fit in that mold, and so forth. The net result of that is that there's this massive battle that we're seeing between Donald Trump, who represents more of a nationalist tendency, and these globalists, put America first, et cetera, and they're fighting it out, and the world is suffering.
Yeah. And they are willing to work with the Chinese as well, it seems, and I guess the Russians, for that matter, particularly with respect to this idea of establishing an alternative to the SWIFT system for banking transactions. Talk us through that very quickly, if you would, Kevin Freeman.
Well, there are two current alternatives. The Russians have one and the Chinese have one. They're interbank transfer systems. So when you transfer from one bank in one nation to another bank in another nation, you go through what we call the SWIFT system, which is the main one. But China has created one called CHIPS, which is CIPS. And that's the Chinese version where they have control. Well, whoever's in control of that system can say if someone gets cut off or not. And we threaten the possibility of cutting off Iran from getting interbank transfers. And Germany says, no, we'll go another way, even creating their own. And so this system that was once centralized, controlled, and under the Western authorities, including the United States, we don't exclusively control. It's not even housed here. It's housed in Brussels. But that system has been an important part of the economic war we've used against drug traffickers, against terrorists, and so forth. That system is being under assault from China, Russia, and now Germany.
Yeah. Again, economic warfare all around. Kevin Freeman, nobody does a better job of chronicling it and helping the rest of us understand the importance of countering it than you do. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. Come back to us again very soon.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We are delighted to have with us Matthew Brodsky, a man whose intellect and knowledge about the Middle East in particular is much prized by us here at Secure Freedom Radio. He has been working on and writing about these subjects for quite some time, notably at the Jewish Policy Center, at Wikistrat, and elsewhere. He has been generous with his time to talk particularly about developments in Syria, about which he recently wrote, co-authored a piece in the National Interest, and I wanted to pick his brains about what seems to be the consolidation of power, if not outright victory, by Bashar Assad and his Iranian and Russian allies. Matt Brodsky, welcome back. It's so good to have you with us.
Always a pleasure.
So, Matt, tell us a little bit about the state of play on the ground at the moment. Is it fair to say that basically Assad and his friends are now in what amounts to sort of a mopping up operation against the last vestiges of organized opposition to the regime?
This will certainly be one of the last major battles that was in the cards for a long period as far as mopping up. However, this is going to be very large. So we're dealing with an area, the Idlib province in northwestern Syria, where you have about, say, 70,000 or so rebel fighters in a population that's incredibly dense. 3.5 million live there. And throughout the war, when Assad has retaken territory with his, of course, Russian and Iranian backers, he's then offered a form of reconciliation agreement, which gives rebels the opportunity to then be shipped away into what becomes the next battleground. So the final frontier has ended up being in Idlib. So this is where there's major friction points, a huge rebel pocket, and where many will make their last stand. And it's going to be, I'm afraid, incredibly bloody. We already know Russia has moved in some 10 naval, some warships, two submarines off the coast. So this is the largest buildup it has had since it got involved since September 2015. So the stage is really set and the offensives are underway right now.
And Matt, is it fair to say that the past practice of the Iranians and their Syrian proxies, as well as, of course, backed by the Russians, has been essentially to follow a scorched earth practice to essentially devastate the areas that they're targeting and then essentially push people who survive to go elsewhere? There's no place else for them to go at this point. So do you anticipate that we'll see once again this kind of mass destruction and then the simple elimination of those who survive since there will be no place further for them to flee?
I'm afraid I do. Russia absolutely has been targeting hospitals. They target schools. They target large civilian population areas. That's the way battle does. Few people have the wherewithal to do what the United States does, what Israel does on a daily basis when it has to engage in warfare, which is to be sure of what it's targeting. So there's going to be very, very heavy casualties, I'm afraid. A key metric will be, of course, whether the regime decides that it's going to use chemical weapons again against the Trump administration's very direct warnings this time. But it's still going to be scorched earth, as you say, and I would expect a large amount of reprisals afterward, because this is just how Assad is thinking. Even his lieutenants in the military have been quoted as saying this publicly, that this is how they're going to be working.
Let's talk a little bit about what this means for not just Assad and his continued control in Syria, but also for the Iranians. Matt, there's been a lot of talk in recent years about Tehran's ambition to carve out a Shia crescent, as it's called, that would take its sphere of influence and sort of territorial access all the way to the Mediterranean. Is that likely to flow from this, or are Israeli objections to such a presence on a permanent basis, particularly in Syria, likely to prevent it?
Israel can do a lot to prevent it, and there are indications that the United States has, at least militarily, is helping out and supporting Israel in this endeavor. Quietly, the U.S., I've seen reports of moving some weaponry and men and material from Iraq into bases in northeast Turkey and in Al-Tanf, which is near the Iraqi-Syrian-Jordanian border, all of which is in a territory that is key to blocking the land bridge. But I think we also might be selling it short when we just talk about transportation logistical lines as being part of Iran's plan for the Shia Crescent. It has been signing with Assad
agreements to rebuild the electric grid. The reason for that is because they're literally trying to link Iran through Iraq to Syria, and it already controls Lebanon. So they're thinking in terms of electricity. They're thinking in much bigger, grander terms than just transportation routes. And so Israel, I think, will continue to act as it's always enforced its red lines when it comes to Iran. And we've seen, I believe, recently that with a few attacks over the weekend. And I think we'll see the United States hopefully maintaining its positions that it currently has, as quietly we've seen over the past few weeks.
Well, it is important to understand that there is a small but real presence of U.S. forces on the ground in this area. They've been threatened by the Russians. They've been threatened by, I believe, the Turks. So it's not a trivial matter that they're in an area that is becoming increasingly under the axis, if you will, of Syria, Iran, and the Russians' control. Speak about Russia's gains as you see them, Matt. Are they likely to be enduring as well?
Russia right now, since neither Iran or Russia have had the money to actually kick in toward reconstructing Syria at the end, they've made deals for bases and, again, like I mentioned, with Iran with the electric grid, while Russia has been given contracts for the hydrocarbon sector. But again, this is where the U.S. and its SDF allies are camped out in eastern Syria. So this is why Russia wants the U.S. out so badly, is they want to cash in on that sector and then create the illusion of Syrian stability so that they can funnel in reconstruction money that will go simply to Assad and be divvied up by Russia and Iran. This is a major pressure release valve from the sanctions that the U.S. has in place against Iran and against Russia separately. They would like to use Syria to escape that pressure.
Yeah, which I guess ties into this whole idea that Assad is now promoting, that Syria is open for business and will welcome investment from all parties to help reconstruct the country, and that essentially it's all over but the shouting, and even the refugees are welcome to come back. Walk us through the truth of all of that, if you would, Matt Brodsky.
Right. See, right after the July 16th Helsinki summit, there was a noticeable change in the rhetoric that came from Assad and Putin, and both reading from the exact same script, which is to say, we welcome home the refugees and we want to rebuild Syria. Assad concentrated, in fact, in a speech that was quoted throughout Russian media on saying not just refugees in general, but specifically Syrian businessmen, which is to say what he wants is to lure back a lot of the Syrian businessmen who have fled and moved into the Gulf states, because he needs to create a new class, a new business oligarchy to attract international investment, since his previous oligarchy has been under U.S. and EU sanctions. So Russia and Assad not only are trying to create the false image of stability in Syria, but then to also create this new business class that they can say, look, here's the new face we have. Your investment is safe with us. Now, Assad has no intention of rebuilding or reconstructing Syria. He could probably get by, I've seen realistic estimates of about $10 billion to rebuild just the areas in useful Syria along the eastern spine that he wants to rebuild. Meanwhile, the UN says the damage is at $388 billion, and that's not even the highest estimate.
Matt Brodsky, we have to leave it at that for the moment. Let's talk again soon, my friend. I hope we'll talk to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.